there's this constant action throughout the movie. It isn't just going to be filming, you know, three people at a table like the cover of the book shows.
I'm William O'Flaherty, and you're listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. If you're a regular listener, then you know that I most frequently interview book authors. That's not the case today. Instead, I'm chatting with someone planning to create a movie based on a book where C.S. Lewis is a central character. That book is called Between Heaven and Hell. The person heading this up is Jim Buchholz, a name you likely have never heard of, but he has many supportive of his project that you will be familiar with, and you'll learn those names during the interview. While at the time this show is posted, a Kickstarter fundraiser is running through July 23rd, 2016, and I'll be discussing that with my guests. The majority of that aspect will be addressed at the end, so this podcast should still prove interesting, even if that Kickstarter has ended. Well, welcome to All About Jack, Jim.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on the podcast. Thank you.
Well, now, first of all, let's focus on the book itself that you are basing the movie upon. It's been out for some time, 1982 to be exact, but some may not have heard about it. So what is the book about?
So basically, I mean, most people know that in, you know, November 22nd, 1963, John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy, was assassinated. But moments later, literally just minutes later, both C.S. Lewis and Aldous Huxley die. So these other two very influential people were kind of back page news instead of front page news, because you had the assassination of a U.S. president. And so Peter Kraft comes up with this idea that this was somehow possibly intentional, and that they all met someplace, you know, somewhere beyond death, and they had this conversation. And it's kind of the crux of figuring out, you know, what was their purpose on Earth, where are they now, and where are they heading next? And so they have this dialogue. So he writes this really wonderful dialogue, you know, between the three, you know, discussing their situation that they're in.
So is the movie only taking the dialogue from the book and putting it on the big screen, or how are you doing it differently, if so?
No, it's not. And that was an important part of making this a movie. I've gotten the comment, the same comment over and over and over from people asking, is this going to be like Dinner with Andre? I've heard in my mentors that I talked to about this, I've talked about it with actually Peter Kraft, the author of the book. Are you going to make the movie like the movie Dinner with Andre? I had this discussion with Ralph Winter, who's a, you know, a big time producer, has produced his films and made billions in Hollywood. I've had it with Hal Poe, a C.S. Lewis scholar. I've even had this, just people tweet after we set up a Twitter account for the movie. I've had people that have no idea who they are find us and tweet to us, so is this going to be like Dinner with Andre? And the answer is that it's not, and I'm trying to avoid that. I don't want someone to come see my movie and think, they're copying from this movie. Now, the thing about Dinner with Andre is that it essentially is what you just said. You have two people sitting at a table in a restaurant for over an hour having a philosophical discussion, and that's like almost their entire movie. And so people think, well, that shouldn't play very well. But it did get a lot of critical acclaim, and so it's a very famous movie. People refer to it all the time. People also have done good parodies of it. I've seen parodies of it. I even remember David Letterman doing one called My Dinner with Andre, and he used Andre the Giant as a parody. So it's a movie out there that a lot of people know about, and they keep referencing it to my movie here. And I want to actually avoid that. So I would say that people are going to be very surprised. People that even know the book well are going to be surprised when they come into the movie theater. As an example, the first lines of dialogue in the book, you have JFK saying, where the hell are we? You know, like that. And that line in the movie doesn't come in for several minutes into the movie, 15, 20 minutes in the movie before that happens. So there's a bunch of lead up to this point. There's also several flashbacks and also present activity going down on Earth the same time that they are in wherever they are. And so there's this constant action throughout the movie. It isn't just going to be filming, you know, three people at a table like the cover of the book shows. throughout the movie. That isn't what's going to happen. And yet that is what kind of happened with Dinner with Andre. And that's why I constantly get that question.
And before we started recording, you were noting that in terms of your approach to this film, that you referenced that there are many times trailers about other films where you kind of get all the essence and all the big twist or you know, a good deal of it, and that you're wanting to avoid that. And so you're wanting to keep some mystery about it, so when people actually see what you are going to put on the screen, to appreciate it even more.
Yeah, I as a movie maker, and in particular as a movie goer, hate it when all the information's in the trailer, when you see all the best stuff in a trailer. For instance, if it's a comedy, I've seen so many trailers where all the best punchlines in the movie are already in the trailer. There's like nothing new, nothing better. And I don't want that. I need to do a media campaign that, of course, gets people into the theaters to see it, but I don't want to give away the best stuff. I have a couple of things. I have people I've talked to, including Peter Kraft and Hal Poe and others, that know the secrets that they're hopefully keeping for me, and surprises about the book. And Peter's very supportive of it. I mean, he really likes the cinematic view that I have of how I'm handling the action portion and the stuff I'm adding. In fact, in the book, it's essentially three people. You know, JFK, C.S. Lewis, Aldous Huxley. There are several more characters in the movie, but we actually want to keep it a secret. I kind of get reminded of movies that have done that for me as a moviegoer that I've really liked. I don't know if you saw Interstellar, but in Interstellar, they kept it a secret that Matt Damon was in the movie, and he became an integral part of the movie, you know, halfway into the movie. And it was one of those things that was a secret. They kept a lot of people secret that you wouldn't know what that was happening. Also, the ending of the movie, I want it to be more open-ended than the book, too. And a movie I referenced there that I really liked that was kind of open-ended is Inception. At the end of Inception, you drove a conversation, actually a social media conversation or a conversation around the world. People talk about, was it a dream or was it not a dream? You know, did the spinning top that was supposed to tell you whether he was in a dream or not, Leonardo DiCaprio or not, was he in a dream? Did it fall over? Did it not fall over? Was it going to fall over? Wasn't it? And it was so funny. I mean, there were rumors going around that the filmmakers intentionally had the spinning top fall over in some theaters and not other theaters to generate this mystery about whether he was dreaming or not. And I don't know if that was true, but that kind of it spread a lot of conversation. So I've made the ending of the book more open-ended for the purpose of driving a conversation after the movie's over with. I want people to talk. This is a philosophical movie, and I want them to have a discussion afterwards.
All right. Well, speaking of mystery, and you were using the word secret a few minutes ago, I guess there's obviously not on purpose you're keeping a secret as to who you are, but this is obviously the biggest thing that you would have you are doing to date. So who is Jim Buchholz? And in terms of like your interest in Lewis, along with how long you've been doing movie making and in your interest in that, how did that develop?
Well, I have been for a very, very long time. I'm a college professor. I'm a professor of physics and mathematics, and I've at California Baptist University, and I've been here for over 28 years. In addition, I'm a filmmaker. In college and high school, I was a stand-up comedian. In fact, my first time ever, I live in California now, the first time I ever came out to California was because I was in the national finals for a talent search contest for college students. And it was at USC, the first time I ever came. When I was working on my PhD, well, master's, I guess I should say, at Texas A&M, I knew that I still wanted to stay in the entertainment industry, and I had to move to California. So I moved out to California and finished my PhD in physics at the University of California, Riverside. And that was intentional to move out here because I wanted to be closer to Hollywood, because I figure, that's where it's going to happen. And then along the way, before I finished my PhD, I fell in love, got married, and had six children. So my role kind of shifted more as a family man. And then about 9 years ago, I did get back into filmmaking and so forth. And at both directing, writing, and acting in the films and stuff like that. And so, and the reason why I was able to do that was basically my kids have been growing up. In fact, of my six children, five have already graduated from college. Four of them are married now and so forth. I've got more time to actually go back and go into the movie making, go back into the movie making industry. That was actually the reason why I moved to California. Now, as far as my interest in Lewis, it was kind of really interesting. So I moved out to California. I had no idea that the C.S. Lewis Foundation was based in California. You know, I'm figuring it's in England, right? Or maybe Ireland or something. It's not in Redlands, California, right? So I moved to Highland, California, or actually first Riverside, then Highland. And Redlands, California is really close to those cities. And my wife was the one that first came across Stan Mattson, who's the president and founder of the C.S. Lewis Foundation. And she comes home one day and she goes, "You know who I met?" And she started telling me about the C.S. Lewis Foundation. This was back in the 90s, and that they were in Redlands. And so I said, "I just have to go over there and meet those people and talk to them." And so I did, and I built a friendship with both Stan and his vice president, Gayn Aniker. I came up with the idea, you know, I wanted to work for the foundation at this. And at this point, I don't believe I had even read Peter Kress's book by this point. This is like mid-90s, late 90s, where I don't think I read his book till 98, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 97. And so I wanted to be part of the foundation and help out. And so my college actually gave me a sabbatical. So I took a sabbatical to go start volunteering for the university, and I became a big part of working with Oxbridge, which is this conference that's every 3 or 4 years in England at both Oxford and Cambridge universities. And that is where I first met Peter Kreft, because the foundation often hires him to be a speaker at many of the functions. And I read his book. And I really just loved this book. Now, I hadn't gotten back into, you know, the entertainment industry yet, but I knew the moment I read the book, I wanted to make this as a film. And but I wasn't going to mention that to Peter. So when I had lunch with him a couple times, you know, at the conferences, and I really enjoyed his book, talked to him about a lot of things. And I probably, you know, just met him a few times on occasions, talked to him about a variety of things that had to do with the C.S. Lewis conferences where he was at and speaking at and so forth. And I didn't bring up the whole idea that I wanted to turn this book into a movie until probably 10 years after I met him, you know, a few years back. So this was when I met him in the 90s. And I finally brought it up. I said, you know, "Hey, I would like to turn your book into a screenplay." And one of the reasons why I waited that long is because I wanted to make the contacts that I needed to make the movie and work. I just didn't want to say, "Hey, this is an interesting idea." So I needed to put several years of filmmaking and working with producers and directors and DPs on several other projects that I did. And bringing this up with them, even before I bought the rights, I started kind of asking around, like, "What do you think about this? What do you think about this?" with several of my friends who are very successful producers. I got a little worried that I was going to bring it up too much, and then someone else would buy the rights. So I did all that, and then I went to Peter, and I sold him on the idea that I could make this movie and make it well, and that I had enough connections. With that said, the first thing Peter told me was that he himself does not own the rights to give the movie rights to his book away. It's actually owned by InterVarsity Press, who publishes the books. So I had to contact them, and I said, "Well, will you put a good word in for me?" So Peter put a good word in for me so that they would, you know, listen to me. With that said, the reason why I say listen to me is because this book has been optioned at least three times by movie studios before I optioned it. Like,
oh, wow.
And so so now, you know, you have, in fact, do you remember Orion Films?
Mm-hmm.
They made Hoosiers and stuff like that. You know, it was going to be a big, you know, blockbuster movie. And then Orion Films went bankrupt. And I think that's how they lost the rights and so forth. Now that I have a contract, there are certain ways you can lose your rights. You know, you have only so many years to make the movie. If you just let those number of years go by, it's often several years, though. But if you let those number of years go by and you don't re-up your movie rights, you know, then they can sell it to someone else. But right now I have the rights and they're locked in and I'm good to go. But when I did contact them, I happened to catch them. And when I contacted InterVarsity Press, I happened to catch them at a time where the movie rights from the previous movie studio had lapsed. And so I said, give me a shot. Now, this is a big shift for them and kind of a risk. And I think this is where Peter helped me out on this, is because you're talking about, you know, they were selling the rights to Orion Films. Now they're going to sell it to Jim Buchholz, you know. How big a movie is he going to make? Is he going to make a $50 million movie? You know, that kind of thing. And that's probably no. But, you know, if anyone wants to donate $50 million to my Kickstarter campaign, I'll take it, you know.
Okay.
But so it was a risk in that sense that they knew this was now going to be an indie movie instead of a studio movie. And I talked him into it, I should say, or I sold him on the idea of what I want to do and how I want to do it. And it worked. And I know Peter would like to see this made, you know, because this book was written clear back in 82. It's been optioned multiple times and the movie never gets made. And this kind of stuff just happens. I mean, think about how long it took The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to finally mm-hmm. be turned into a movie. I mean, Sony owned the rights for so many years and just didn't make the movie, you know, for one reason or another. And then finally it comes out. And I personally think that if The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which did well, I mean, you know, over 100 million or whatever it was in the theaters, it would have done even better had they gotten it out before the Harry Potter series, because they were now kind of competing with that kind of level of animation and stuff, instead of being kind of the first to do that and then making Harry Potter compete with them. And so I think it would have been nicer if they'd got it out sooner. But it took lots of years for it just to get done. And some of that's because it is a big studio, and big studios buy the rights to a lot of books. And they, you know, they only make so many, and sometimes books sit on their shelves and no one's working on it. To where me, a smaller company is working on one book, not many books, and this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to make this movie.
More specifically, how did your interest in Lewis's books come about?
So my interest in Lewis, it's kind of twofold. One came through my pastor, who married my wife and I. It was also our next door neighbor. And his wife used to read the Chronicles of Narnia to my children, and so forth. And so I really appreciate that. And they grew up on that. And I really like that. As an adult, the books that I've read that I really enjoyed would be Mere Christianity and Screwtape Letters. And so I started, so I got a great interest. And I also liked the stories I've heard about Mere Christianity and the number of people that book has brought to Christianity. This is not a book. I mean, Mere Christianity is not a book that's going to bring little kids, you know, to Christianity. That's kind of what Narnia is there for. This is for adults. And I've always had a curiosity in how do you get someone that has never been a Christian, not brought up with, you know, Christian value stuff, to be interested in Christianity and so forth. And so I often get very inquisitive when I find people like this that, yeah, I became a Christian when I was 40. And I actually, so I'm like, how? Why? You know, and I start asking questions. So I've heard so many stories from some very influential people that lead back to C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity was what directed them to becoming a Christian. Good example is Chuck Colson. Okay, Chuck Colson, Prison Ministries. You know, he was he had told me that He knew he was going to prison. He was Nixon's lawyer, and he had heard Billy Graham and everything come into the White House, and he said that it would come in one ear and go out the other, kind of a thing, and then when he knew he was heading off to prison, someone had given him this book, Mere Christianity, which he'd never heard of, to read. And he read that in prison and became a Christian and started prison ministries. Another individual that I've talked to that had a similar experience was Francis Collins here. Francis was an atheist working on his PhD in biology. And he had also picked up the book or someone had given it to him, Mere Christianity, and it drove him to be a Christian too. So I like this philosophical talk. And if people don't know who Francis Collins is, he was the head of the Human Genome Project for the United States. And he presently has a presidential appointment. He is the head of the National Institute of Health. He's like the top biologist in the country. And he says he became a Christian after reading that book, Mere Christianity. So philosophical books like that that address those issues, I really like.
Now, we're more specifically get into the Kickstarter aspect, which is going on until July 23rd of 2016. But overall, in terms of making the movie, something that people may wonder about is in terms of any red tape. Have you crossed your T's, dotted your I's in terms of any legal thing to prevent you from having characters like JFK, Huxley, or even C.S. Lewis?
So on these issues, of course, everyone has to cross these issues and figure out how to handle them. For the most part, having done my own research and also communicated with a couple different entertainment lawyers and producers, and I even contacted a producer who had been sued. He won his lawsuit, but I just asked him about it and so forth. And it was a major movie that he had done, so I don't want to bring it up, but he did win. So I've asked these things, and my script is, from all accounts, really safe. I'm not defamatory of anybody, and in fact, if you've passed away, I mean, as you can tell, people often write telltale books after someone's passed away because, then the person that's being attacked is dead, and you're pretty much almost safe. Now, let me say, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not giving advice to anyone. So don't take this like you're listening to a lawyer, anyone listening to this podcast. All I'm saying is that I have spoken with entertainment lawyers and producers that know about my book and what's in it and so forth. I can't tell you they've read all of the script, but it seems I'm pretty safe. Now, with that said, I also will have an entertainment lawyer go through the entire script, and I will get what's called omissions and error insurance. These are all standard things that incorporate the movie. You do all these things to protect you, and you basically don't even get the insurance if you haven't already done your due diligence and made sure that you're safe on things. So that's just it's just kind of a standard thing, and I've already started that. One thing about filmmaking today, it's vastly different than even 10 or 20 years ago. A lot of it's because the internet and how people access movies and stuff like that. It's like you're doing everything all at the same time. It used to be, you come up with an idea, storyboard, do a script. After you've done written the script, then you go try to sell it to someone. Then after you sell it, to someone, then you try to raise money. After you raise money, now you talk about distribution. You do it all at once now. I've already been talking to distributors, as if the movie's done, which it isn't, so it's one of those things that all these different aspects I've already started worrying about and talking about. So I have already talked about, this coming out in theaters and what issues there could be with the characters. And it seems that, this script's pretty safe.
All right, well, now let's go into more specifically about Kickstarter. Even though there will be those who listen to this after it ends July 23rd, 2016, you're raising on this Kickstarter $45,000. Now, that doesn't sound like enough money to make more than, a 10-minute film, if that long. So, what is this money accomplishing that you're raising?
So that's a good question. And people can look at the bottom of the Kickstarter page where I have a section about where your money's going, kind of thing. It's called a help support a section, and I have three different levels there. Basically, this successful Kickstarter campaign will be used for crew and equipment, some legal. We just got done talking about legal and insurance, and then location, and then some locations and travel. We have some travel we have to do that actually involves getting other people on board, other investors at another level, to get us bigger name actors and so forth like that. So now let's say that I raise these. I want to assure people of this. Let's say I raise the 45,000, and then all the other investors I've lined up kind of fall to the wayside, whatever. The movie will still be made. So how do you make a movie for 45,000? And by the way, the InterVarsity Press, who gave me the rights, knows that too. They know that, they're not going to block me and say, no, you can't make a movie for that little. They've already agreed to it. So I mean, and that's like the lowest level, right? That's worst case scenario kind of thing. But in that sense, I've been working for several years now with people who have done this. Of course, they end up in these non-union movies. Sometimes you can get SAG actors. That always brings the price up, though. But SAG, I've talked to SAG on this issue multiple times. I've gone down to the SAG offices in LA, and you can get special deals, which I would qualify for, where you just pay the SAG actors $125 a day, and you keep the price down because it's a low-budget indie film. And then you get a lot of in-kind services. I mean, I did this for my last film I shot. I had three expenses for the last film I shot. I didn't pay for any of my permits. I didn't pay for any of my location fees. I had to get insurance. I had to have the County of Riverside covered, but they gave me their building for free. County of Riverside gave me the permits for free. I got free use of a RED camera, and I used the brand new Red Dragon that's filmed in 6K, even though no one has 6K projectors. So we downgrade it to 4K, but we overshoot to get the high quality in case we have to zoom in and stuff like that. And I got everyone to just I had about a crew of 20 plus people, and the only person that I actually even paid on the crew, because people want to make movies out here in LA, was my lead actress, who happened to end up turning SAG, but which is Screen Actors Guild. So I paid for insurance on that. I paid for food. That's the one thing you have to do. The one thing that is like everyone says in the low film budget, you feed people well. So you feed people well, and you get your you covered insurance wise, and you can go a long way then with asking for favors, that kind of a thing. So I've done that multiple times. It's not. I mean, no one wants to do that, but we do it all the time. We help each other out all the time on making movies, and who's good enough, who's good at it, and who you can trust, and so forth like that. So that's like the lowest level. Okay, now that's not my intent. My intent is I have at level two, I have basically a set of investors that are going to help me bring in some recognizable faces and names. Because as I've talked with many of my producer friends that are mentoring me on this, and I've got some really good people mentoring me, names go a long way. I mean, I'll just give an example that one of the producer friends who's done really well with indie films, I mean, his indie films made in the millions in theaters. He said, "Look, you could make an indie film for $100,000, and then you could say, let me make that same movie I can make for $100,000, but spend $200 more just for names and pay these names people, and you have a better chance at getting your 300,000 back than your 100,000 back, hands down." And he basically says, "I can distribute any movie that has the right level names in it." So I can't name the people that we've been looking at and seeing what it's going to cost us and so forth. I don't want to name it here on the podcast, but we're already in that process. And so that's level two, is to raise a lot more money. But it really is for the great actors. I'll give you one more example here from an acquaintance of mine that raised $10 million. This was a $10 million movie. And he said they really made the movie for under $1 million. $9+ million was for actor salaries, and eight of it was one person. They paid $8 million for one person, $1 million for the others, and they did the movie for just hundreds of thousands of dollars for the most part. And so a lot of these big budget movies is because you want a big name, you want an A-list actor, you got to pay for it, and so forth. Now I will say this, my level two, which is, let's get some named actors that are going to get distribution for this film, including we're getting people that would have good distribution around the world, not just in the US, which is important to us, because of course, where Huxley and Lewis are from. The thing I've got going for me is that these guys, those two I just mentioned, passed away in their 60s. So I'm not trying to get someone maybe that's at the peak of their career, if you can understand what I'm saying. People that have already had substantial careers when they were younger, that now they're of the age that they fit the role really well, but their price tag isn't of getting them in a movie isn't nearly what it used to be. That's actually an advantage I have to casting this movie, and that's why I mean by we're looking in to prices, and communicating with people like, how much would it be? How much do we have to raise for this person to play Lewis, for this person to play Kennedy, and so forth. And that's kind of level two. And then level three is basically kind of turning in your indie film into a studio level film, where it's kind of, cut no corners, so to say. You have millions to play with. Now, of course, that's not who I am, just to throw millions out. But we have already contacts for that too, but until the Kickstarter campaign goes over, we're not going to do anything about that. And afterwards, we will go and meet with them. And it's not just, I mean, I've met with producers multiple times and fundraisers multiple times on this issue, but it's not just one of our contacts is not just that, hey, I'm going to get my foot in the door. I can't name him, unfortunately, I can't name him, but I'm going to get my foot in the door, and he's already read the book. So that's important. That's a key. So like I said, these are really vastly different goals. Making a low budget indie movie, a medium budget indie movie, and then a high budget indie movie that looks like a studio movie kind of thing. Well, let's put it this way: at whatever level I make, I want to make it look like it was a studio movie. The question is, who are my stars? That's just about the biggest question when it comes to how much money it's going to cost you.
Okay, and I do encourage people to look, as it's still up, the Kickstarter does explain the level one, two, and three in a concise way, but it is at the very, very bottom of the page after a long list of the people involved. In fact, I missed it the first time I was looking at the page and didn't realize that you had gone into that. So we do encourage people to check that out. And then related to the Kickstarter, if it's still time when people are listening to this to participate, there will be those who are, of course, here at the end here, but you've already spoken in terms of noting that you're not just some lone ranger, that you have an idea, you've drafted up a script, and you're wanting to, move forward. You're much further beyond that. In fact, one of the aspects that you're at the end of the Kickstarter page, you note is that you've already spent thousands of dollars already in getting to where you're at right now, and so you're trying to move beyond to be able to make it here. But I'm wanting you to focus, without emphasizing too much on the rewards, speak again about those who have been supportive of the movie effort.
Well, I have what I would call a set of mentors. Some you're going to recognize, maybe some not. One that I spent some time with is Ralph Winter. Ralph goes clear back to Star Trek days. He was an executive producer on multiple Star Treks. Associate producer, I think, on the first one, but executive producer and executive producer on later Star Trek movies. He also produced the first two X-Men series. He produced the original Fantastic Four, and so and he's a strong Christian in Hollywood. I mean, he's an outspoken Christian in Hollywood, and so he's been mentoring me on this, and we've actually had discussions about, how come so many studios have optioned this, and it never gets made, you know, because he's in the industry. This happens all the time. I said, what do you know, or what, how do you feel about this particular book? How come it's not been made yet by the bigger studios? And he gave me some really good advice, and I rewrote the script heavily, you know, after he talked about this. He said, well, it reads like a play, not a movie. The book reads like a play. And he goes, you have to make it a movie, you know. And so after I made it a movie, you know, in the script, I contacted Peter Kreft about it. And he's one of my other supporters, obviously. It's his book. And he really loves the changes. You know, some people can be, in fact, we had some really good conversations, Peter and I, about, you know, he's on the side of what most literary people are, you know, the book's always better than the movie. The book's always better than the movie, you know. And so we tried to start talking about movies that were better than the books, and we're trying to come up with them. And we were saying, well, I think this movie was better than the book. And we were having this long discussion like that. And honestly, I think Peter would be super happy if people said they liked the movie better than the book, only because, you know, it supports his great idea and it would sell more of his books and so forth like that. Because he kind of knows that you've got to do something with this. This is great dialogue, you know, but you've got to make it an action movie of some sort. And like I said, on his own, just like many other people, Peter Kreft asked me, you know, without me bringing it up to him, is it going to be like Dinner with Andre? He brought that up too. And so I have to avoid that, you know. I have to avoid it looking like a play or Dinner with Andre. And I've done that, and I can't give away too much. But I will say Peter's excited about that. Another person that I have that's been mentoring me is Hal Poe. I think you know Hal Poe, CSO mm-hmm. scholar from Union. And we've been talking regularly on this, and he's helped me out a lot with that. He's also some of my perks. When you'll see some of his perks offerings. One of his perks already sold out, by the way, some autographed books of his on my campaign site. Also, I don't know if you know Rebecca Verstraten. She's the director of the Los Angeles Film Study Center. She's also been mentoring me on this. The C.S. Lewis Foundation, of course, since I volunteered for them for years. And of course, they've given me also, when you look at the site, perks to help raise funds for the movie. So they've been very, 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 very supportive of me, which I greatly appreciate. And InterVarsity Press. I mean, they didn't have to sell me the rights, knowing that, you know, I'm not a major blockbuster studio, and they went ahead and did it. And it probably was a lot of the support from Peter, you know, telling them, go ahead, you know, so... I really appreciate that. And then there's producers and directors that I can't mention their name yet because they may or may not end up a legal part of the film. So I need to wait and see where we are on them that I've worked with, but that have also been mentoring me, and they'll help me even if they don't end up. I've got multiple people that have been very kind to me in Hollywood, actually, believe it or not, that have been very kind to me, saying they'll help me whether they end up being a producer on the film or not.
Well, now, on the lighter side, what has been the most interesting experience so far that you've had in your endeavor to create this film, Between Heaven and Hell?
Well, I would actually have to probably say what I mentioned earlier. It's the constant being asked, is the movie going to be like Dinner with Andre? So if you don't know that movie, you should go ahead and look it up, find out about it. Because, I mean, I recently got a tweet from someone that I don't know that just started following us on Twitter, and that's exactly what they asked. They go, hey, is this going to be like Dinner with Andre? I hope it's more edifying. You know, and they just people are just constantly address that. And I hope people go into or come out of the theater and go, hey, that wasn't at all like Dinner with Andre.
That's what the headline review will say.
Yes.
Maybe. Okay. Well, I've been enjoying talking with you, Jim, here. Let's go ahead and wrap up. What final words or appeal would you like to make to those who are listening now in time to support the Kickstarter and are hesitant in doing so?
Well, first of all, the way Kickstarter works, it is a pledge. Like, you can go in and pledge right now, and nothing happens till it closes on July 23rd. And if we don't meet our goal, nothing happens. So it starts off as a pledge. You go in and you have perks in there that you receive for pledging your donation. And there's some nice perks in there given from the foundation and from Peter Kreft and from Hal Poe and others. And you can, you know, some of them are, you know, here's the film and the soundtrack. And you get digital copies of those. You can just download when it comes out. and so forth. So you'll get it before it's on DVD and that kind of stuff. So there's lots of nice stuff like that, but it is a pledge. So you don't have to have the money right now. And like I said, if you don't raise money, Kickstarter does nothing. They just do nothing. It kind of goes away. So, and the other thing is, I don't think if you're hesitant about who am I, well, I'm not going anywhere. I'm very public. I mean, I've been at California Baptist University for over 28 years. You can find me. I can't hide. So you can always track me down and talk to me about the movie. I am going to make this movie. So I don't think you really have to worry about that flight risk or anything. If anyone's hesitant about who am I, they can look me up right now. And so I just like to encourage people to go to the easiest way to find the Kickstarter campaign is just type in your browser Between Heaven and Hell, the film.com. And that actually has a direct link to the Kickstarter. So that web page will automatically just send you straight to Kickstarter and you'll see the campaign. So it's between, don't forget the film at the end. So it's Between Heaven and Hell, the film.com.
All right. And of course, I'll have a link in the show notes for that. But people listening by podcast, of course, they can always rewind, make sure they get it if they're not to where they can get back to my podcast and such. So, okay, well, it's been enjoyable to have you on the show, Jim. Thanks for joining me, and hopefully we can have some updates in a few months down the road.
Thank you very much, and thanks so much for having me on the show.
As just mentioned, you can follow along with the progress of the movie by going to BetweenHeavenAndHellTheFilm.com. And I hope to catch up with Jim in a month or two after the Kickstarter ends to find out the latest news. So if you're listening to this in the fall of 2016 or later, then be sure to look for another podcast about the movie. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Don't forget to visit the show notes for direct links to the Kickstarter to visit if it is still running, and there is a direct link to the website Jim mentioned to track the current news about the film. You can find those show notes either by going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is most easily found. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, provides links back to where the audio files are located, but also has other features with a variety of articles related to Lewis that include a daily fact and quote related to him, and then I also have a series exploring quotations attributed to Lewis that may not be by him. At the time this podcast is first posted, the latest news shows were brief talks from the 2016 Taylor Colloquium. I shared my talk related to the Screwtape letters, and also a talk from Brenton Dickinson, where he shared a surprising link between those letters and what is commonly known as the Space or Ransom Trilogy. In addition to those new shows, I also post previously released podcasts on my iTunes feed that you can also find at the Podbean address. If you don't know how to find the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. Finally, speaking of Screwtape, my book C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, A Companion and Study Guide to the Screwtape Letters, is available online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com.